for people or whatever. But a lot of those songs that we heard from Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes and those people, the musicians were white guys. And they were making soul music. And you make that point about what went on in that period down at Stax, down in Memphis, also down in Alabama, as you talk later on in the book. Yeah, about what was going on there. And here's the thing I love about that time period musically is that you can really see things start to come to life. Let's talk about some of the big players. 65 was a year when Bob Dylan, not only did he challenge authority, but he challenged his core listener. He challenged his, what we would call in radio, his P1, the person that was always with him. And he said, basically, to hell with you. I'm moving on. I see something else. I'm going to evolve here. And it was not well received, was it?
No, I mean, from their perspective, the folk music scene, they had, you know, in the 30s, Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, all those guys, they were like fighting for the working man. And then they got kind of all blacklisted in the communist scare of the 50s. And they had been kind of driven underground, but things started to loosen up, and, you know, Pete Seeger was back, and the folk music was at a big revival. And then Bob Dylan suddenly was like, hey, I want to hang out with the Stones and the Beatles more. I always wanted to do rock and roll back in high school. I was doing that. I'm going to do rock and roll. And they, a lot of the old folkies were like, man, you're selling out for the flashy, dumb pop songs to make a lot of money, and you're like, you're not doing songs about the civil rights movement blowing in the wind anymore. You're totally becoming a meathead. But, you know, in reality, he was pushing his lyrics. Suddenly, Like a Rolling Stone was number two record, and that was like the most poetic, weird lyrics that had ever been on the radio. So he continued to be like a Picasso, avant-garde, crazy guy. He just wasn't kind of staying in the old boxes that they used to be in.
The thing I love about your book is you start off with a timeline of the year, and you go through a selected timeline at the front, and then you proceed chronologically to go through the year and everything that the year had. Obviously, there's always stuff left on a cutting room floor anytime you have a work like this. What didn't make the book that you wish you could have written about, or what did you write about that you wish you could have written more about?
A couple things come to mind. On the one hand, books, because of, for commercial reasons, it had to come in around the length that it is now. I would kind of go off a little bit before 1965 and set things up, but the editor, who is a great guy, Rob Kirkpatrick, he was pretty militant. He was like, no, you know, you don't have room just because we got to stay in the budget area and everything, you know. So things kind of got cut off right before and right after, just so it focused on 65. There's been a lot of complaints that I just stayed on the U.S. and the U.K. and Jamaica, a section on Sky, like Bob Marley. But there was tons of stuff going on, like in France. It would have been great to branch out into different parts of the world. There was a lot of great artists that would have delved in a lot more to, you know, like Donovan, for instance. He has like a 50-year retrospective coming out now. I didn't really go into his stuff as much as, in retrospect, I wish I could have. I could have gone on forever. It would have been great going into everything, but I kind of had to cut it down a lot.
That does make sense, because I know people wouldn't understand that, because the book does come in at 330 or so pages, and I guess people would probably go, well, geez, if you can't say it in that, it's how are you going to say it? The truth is, when it comes to critics, they're always going to have something to criticize. I love this book because when I just look at 1 month, for instance, I mean, I'm just staying in this selected timeline, and you expound on some of this, not all, some, like John Coltrane, as he released A Love Supreme, which is just unbelievable. And this is in February of that year. And then we go, James Brown records Papa Got a Brand New Bag. Those are both on February 1, by the way. You've Lost That Love and Feeling that you talk about, I think is one of the most, it might be the highest selling, one of the highest selling songs of all time. And it's been recorded by so many different folks. And then you have Buck Owens, who you talk about in the book effusively. And you talk about him as a very important figure from that time period. And then on the 21st of that month, Malcolm X is assassinated. That's 1 month out of 1965, and that's the 28-day month. It just speaks to the incredible depth of that year, doesn't it?
Yeah, the month I thought was the craziest was the month after that, too. They had Selma going on, and the pill was in the Supreme Court, and the Beatles got dosed with LSD, and they had the first teach-in against Vietnam and the University of Michigan, and Bob Dylan released Bringing It All Back Home all within a week. You know, the Supremes had a big hit. And then in July, they were coming up on this anniversary where I think the same day, I have to look at my list, but the same day or the same week, you had Like a Rolling Stone, Do You Believe in Magic, Help, Eve of Destruction. They're all coming out like in a week of each other. It's fantastic.
What I find interesting is these artists musically, and by the way, the book is called 1965, The Most Revolutionary Year in Music, Andrew Grant Jackson. And you also have a website, right? There's kind of a compendium website with this as well?
Yeah, it's called 1965book.com, and it has, I try to put excerpts up and then videos to accompany, so there's a lot of videos on there, and sometimes links to other people writing things and stuff.
That's great. When you talk about that year, 1965, the thing that really stands out to me is, in popular music, these people are all pushing each other to make better and better and more interesting and more unique sounds. And it's like that rivalry crosses genres, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, like we were mentioning Buck Owens, the Beatles had a bunch of country-inflected songs because they were on the same label as him and they loved his stuff. And then he started performing a few Beatles tunes in concert, but he got a lot of grief from country fans going like, what are you doing talking about the Beatles? You should just play country. So he took kind of the opposite stance of Bob Dylan, because he put out an ad in the big country trade magazine saying, I will always be a country artist, and everything I play will be country. Years later, he said, I always considered rockabilly country, too. So he gave himself some wiggle room there, because rockabilly, I guess that was like both rock and country.
I guess what's funny about that period, and especially that year, is that many of these songs that you talk about stand the test of time. Do you think that helps make this that much better of a subject? The fact that Like a Rolling Stone sounds just as great as it did then. The fact that Martha and the Vandellas, Nowhere to Run, the sheer force of the words and the way that song's recorded. There's like a desperation in the air that year. Even from the Motown acts, there's, as polished as they were, there's a desperation. Much of this stands the test of time. Do you think that helps make this a more interesting subject?
Yeah, because I've been kicking myself trying to think of another year that, not in the 60s, because the later 60 years have also been well covered in books, but that can equal this or top this. And I've been having a hard time thinking of years that actually, since that time, have the huge amount of great material that stands the test of time. I was thinking today, you know, it's funny because people say, because I wasn't actually alive that year, you know, what am I doing writing it? But
right.
When I was in the 80s, well, I heard a lot of it from my parents, but then they only had, like, maybe the greatest hits of Simon and Garfunkel, and I kept digging deeper into it. And for whatever reason, the music resonated with me the most, and I kept going back to it since I was in high school in the 80s. So what's that, 30 years? I don't know, 30 years ago now? So at least even for me, a second generation, it stood the test of time. Just over the decades, I kept going back to it all the time. It definitely is a constant wellspring of quality stuff.
And against that backdrop, you have issues in our country like the March from Selma. In your book, you spend an awful lot of time, and I told you this in an email, the stuff you wrote on the Watts riots, in as much as some of the unrest we've seen in our major cities recently, Baltimore and some other examples, the stuff you wrote on the Watts riot from that time period is really haunting. Because that's going on in the period of white flight from many of our major cities. And that chapter just, wow, it was really painful to read that.
Yeah, especially because I think it was that week, a couple of days after LBJ passed the Voting Rights Act, which was a response to Selma. So at the very pinnacle of the civil rights movement, where they legally attained what they were looking for, then the huge Watts riot happened, and that created a big conservative backlash. It added a lot more racial tension to the country, you know, a lot more riots happened after that. So it was just amazing that it happened right after the Voting Rights Act thing happened. It's strange how it happened right then. I was from Detroit, and so my dad lived downtown in Detroit, and Detroit had a 67 riot, which I was always kind of fascinated about. So even though Watts, different year, different thing, there were a lot of similarities, so in a way it was very interesting to me because it reflected a lot on where I was growing up too. You know, that's one reason why I've always been kind of fascinated with riots in a way.
And your chapter on it, against the backdrop that it just kind of started out as seemingly innocuous people blowing off steam, and it just escalated and escalated and escalated, didn't it?
Yeah. A cop was driving down the street. Some guy said, hey, there's some drunk driver going over there. And so the cop went and saw these two young guys who were weaving in the lanes or whatever, so he pulled them over, and then their mom ended up coming over there, and everybody started yelling at each other, and a huge crowd gathered, and you know, they took the mom and the two guys away, and then just particularly a lot of kids, a lot of younger people, they just started throwing rocks, and a lot of them were saying, this is for Selma, you know, this is for Malcolm X, who had just been assassinated. You know, there was Selma, the Bloody Sunday, which had been in that March, which was just a couple months before, they had had the National Guard beating peaceful demonstrators and stuff, so there was just a lot of tension in the air, and it just kind of, you know, erupted.
1965, the most revolutionary year in music. Andrew Grant Jackson is joining us, nice enough to give us some time today. Thomas Dunn Books, St. Martin's Press, an incredible year, 1965. You pick this book up and you go, oh my, no wonder he is declaring this the type of year that it was. Not only did you have the civil rights tension, you have what's going on in Vietnam, you have all these seminal artists that are starting.